Welcome to Command Control Power, a weekly podcast hosted by three certified members of the Apple Consultants Network, drawing from over 30 years combined experience. We talk shop, interview vendors and colleagues, and share what we've learned while operating our technology consulting practices. This is Joe Saponari of CIMAC, and my two co-hosts are Sam Valencia of the HCS Technology Group and Jerry Zygmunt of MacWorks. We are live at commandcontrolpower.com, the first Tuesday of every month, where new episodes are posted weekly. Thanks for listening. This episode of Command Control Power is brought to you commercial-free and is made possible by our Patreon sponsors. You can help bring more commercial-free episodes by going to patreon.com/cmdctrlpwr and supporting the show with a monthly pledge. Thank you for your support of Command Control Power. We're very pleased this week to be joined by Todd Kane, President of Evolved Management Consulting. Todd, thanks for joining us on Command Control Power.
Awesome. Great to be here. Thanks, you guys.
And so we were introduced to you by your friend Luis Geraldo. You guys have worked together in the past, and I guess you had Luis on your podcast recently, Evolved Radio. What do you guys talk about on your show?
So my podcast focuses on the evolution of business and technology, and try to focus a lot on how technology is changing business. And then just otherwise, I talk to a lot of thought leaders and business leaders. In general, kind of what I find interesting. I kind of surf around to find cool people to connect to and neat businesses and interview the owners and operators and try to collect input and ideas on evolving technologies or changes in business. So the episode with Luis was, we were just chatting about managed services in general.
So when you say the intersection of technology and business or how technology is affecting business, I'm always reminded of, I ask people sometimes, like, do you remember when jobs like were performed without computers? Like, do you remember when you would have something to do if your computer was down? And these days there's like literally nothing to do. I mean, if you show up for work, I mean, pretty much everyone is like in email all day and doing some kind of research on the web and using some kind of, different applications and tools to their job. So I don't know, is that sort of the background context for the subjects at hand, or does it go much more, nuanced than that?
I would say it's more broad. Yeah, it's definitely stems from that idea. One of the presentations that I used to do around productivity and, the GTD methodology, I'd actually start out with a picture of a person sitting in front of a switchboard. And, I'd ask people, can anyone tell me what this is? Like, what's this a picture of? And they, there would be sort of some random guesses, like, a switchboard operator, just a lady, whatever the suggestions were. And the answer is actually, it's a computer. A computer used to be a description of a job, right? And it's now evolved into that it's its own kind of entity. It's a work product, a tool that we use to do our everyday jobs. And, that's a huge component of it, that, that's why IT is so critical in every aspect of the business. It used to be, even fairly recently, that if computer problems hit the company, then, maybe email was down and people were kind of panicked, but generally they could still kind of do their job. And more, that's really not the case. And, every aspect of every company has some technical aspect to it. It's not just email anymore. It touches every part of the business. And that's what I find really fascinating is, what does this all mean? What's the direction that we're heading in, and how will technology continue to evolve business in sort of all aspects?
That's really interesting. I mean, people used to be experts at using their tools. You'd go to work and you were an expert at using the tools in your tool belt. And now the generic tool is a computer. And if you are at an expert level with sort of maintaining those systems, you can be a lot more effective than the person next to you who needs to call IT for every little question. It's just interesting how we now need specialists to maintain the tools we use every day.
Yeah. And the far-reaching aspects of this are becoming a lot more apparent as well. Like, some of the topics that I've covered are things like cryptocurrency and how that's going to affect banking, as well as contract management, kind of all of those evolving industries that are fairly immature and they're still in their baking phase. They're not quite ready for prime time, but they'll have radical effects on how people conduct business and the level of integration of the computer and the internet as to how those things touch our daily lives. So it'll be really interesting to see. Even the recent one that I did was on drones, and I interviewed a friend of mine that organizes a drone racing league, And, you know, that, again, like most people don't even know that that exists yet. You know, a couple of years ago, there was a prize, $1 million prize for drone racing in Dubai. So, you know, just the, you know, most people are kind of aware of drones, but only probably in the last year or so. But, you know, you scratch the surface and you find this huge subculture under all of these emerging technologies. And you can kind of, the more you chat with people that are involved in them, the deeper you can kind of realize how much technology is going to be changing our fundamental lives on a day-to-day basis, both at work and outside.
What I see in our own, or in, I think we've shared this feeling in the past as well on the show, in our own practices, is that a lot of the people who are in charge of running these companies don't have any kind of an understanding of the technology that they use every day. It's like hiring a garage full of mechanics and very few of them knowing how to do anything beyond working the wrenches or the basic tools to work on the car. Anything beyond that, they need to call somebody else. So I think as we become more and more reliant on technology, there's a lot of companies that are very, very beholding to technology individuals like ourselves to keep their companies operational. That's a really interesting concept when you think about it. And there's a series that's airing right now in the United States called Mr. Robot. I think it's in its second season on the USA Network. And it's fantastic. It's science fiction, but it takes some of these precepts and sort of runs with them. Like, well, what happens when...
Don't spoil anything, Jerry.
When technology runs amok. And then that's a frightening thing, is that the people who are running these companies don't have any control a lot of times over the highly reliant technology that runs their company.
That kind of reminds me of a joke that I used to banter with people when I was doing tech support. Is, you know, they immediately, people always get very, very cautious, and they're like, oh, you know, sorry, I'm not very good with computers, ha ha ha, kind of that nervous laughter. I used to joke with them like, that's okay, that keeps the rest of us in business, right? Like, you're the majority for not understanding technology. And maybe that's changing to some degree, but I've heard the expression that every company is a technology company. You know, you don't have to be building software or working on, you know, computers and servers to be considered a technology company, because technology is ever present in all businesses, regardless of what they're actually producing or working on or service that they're providing. And also, love Mr. Robot. Fantastic show.
I'm about two episodes behind, so don't you guys say anything. In respect to that, being in any form of business that I've been working in as a client, you've seen those times, or I've seen those times, where something goes down, the server goes down or what have you, and literally people just start popping up from their cubes because they have nothing to do. They just start standing around talking to each other, and they can't access the database, they can't access email, they can't research this quote or anything like that. All things come to a stop. Right. And it's amazing how much that just completely stops. And in any business that, I mean, of course, there are certain exceptions aside. And to your point, Jerry, you know, the owners or the people that run these companies, they really, a lot of times, I agree, don't have that information about how this all works. And it strikes fear into their hearts when something does go wrong and they look at you with a panic that they just want you to fix it. Also with blame as well, if something doesn't go right.
And that's really where, you know, IT consultancy and the managed service practices really have evolved in the modern day, is that it's more a true partnership. And, you know, when I'm advising clients in, you know, their client list and what the relationships look like, the key thing that you generally have to look for is the clients that treat you like a vendor are probably not going to be great long-term partners. But the people that treat you much more like a partner in the company, they almost view you as a part or a division of their own company, that you manage the IT and the IT touches all the facets of the rest of their organization. If they understand and grasp the criticality that technology plays in their business, that's important, even if they don't care about the technology, because in a lot of cases, they don't want to know. That's why they've hired you, right? So, you know, a lot of people want to, you know, explain their business to their clients. And that's not the sort of the way that it's generally supposed to work, is you have to understand their business and understand how your business applies within it. And that's sort of that role dynamic that needs to change as the industry matures, that we're moving away from technology to a service organization that focuses on technology.
What are some signs from your perspective, Todd, that, you know, new consultants or existing consultants can look for when entering into these new relationships with, you know, a business early on? How can you tell that the CEO or the management is looking at IT as a critical component of their business and looking at you as a partner in their success? Are there any sort of, you know, signs you can look for?
certainly the level of interest. So, you know, if they're engaging you as a service provider and engaging in a partnership, but they never meet with you, that to me is kind of a red flag, unless it's a larger organization and it makes some sense that, you know, a VP or a CFO or a high level manager is responsible for the management of that. But it's always a little scary when you're dealing with a client where you've never met the owner and they don't seem to, you know, have an interest or care in understanding the role that you play and developing that partnership. So I think that's certainly a big one. And then the other is people that are just really focused on, you know, the dollars and the dollars as a vendor. So, you know, I'm going to pay you X per hour and these guys over here are going to do it for $5 cheaper. So maybe that's a better deal for me. If they're just purely focused on the dollars rather than the level of service and the level of partnership that you're going to play, then that's probably a red flag long term. And that's why, you know, I'm a big proponent of the managed service style, because, you know, the budgets are predictable, revenue is predictable for you, and service is set around certain SLAs and other, you know, bottom barriers of quality of service, and everybody should be pleased with that. And if you just want to pay, you know, when there's a problem, that's probably not going to be a healthy partnership. And the part that a lot of people don't seem to grasp in that is that if there's an emergency and something explodes in the middle of the night and you're under a managed service agreement, generally you're covered. Whereas, you know, if you're under T&M, sure, you know, 2 months you're paying $200 for that T&M support, and then something goes horribly wrong and you're left with a $2,000 bill instead of a $200 bill. So you never want to use the term insurance, but there is certainly an idea that reflects around that, you know, you're spreading out your cost, you're limiting your risk, right? And if people can view how technology limits their risk and plays to the upside in enabling their organization, then that's usually a great partnership. You know, they want to be interested in not necessarily like the technology, like what are the cool software, the cool hardware, you know, I want all these fresh, fancy new pieces of equipment, but they want to understand, you know, how would a CRM or an ERP or, you know, an online quoting system or a pay portal or something, if they're interested in how technology can enable their business, then that's probably someone that's going to be fairly forward thinking.
I think I'm going to bring you along with me at my next managed services pitch. I think you could do a good job to convince some. I have some clients that I would, you know, as you were talking about this, I have some clients that are easily red flags in just the description of how what they pay attention to in terms of the dollars versus the actual management of their business as a whole. They don't think of it as that you're the caretaker for their entire organization. They just think, can you fix something when it breaks and how fast can you do it? And they don't understand that that's such a reactive approach and you can handle things so much better with a managed services approach. But sometimes it is a tough sell. I mean, we've gone through this discussion before on the show. It's something that you really have to put forth, and sometimes those red flag clients are never going to get it.
Yeah, this is another aspect that I, you know, as I'm moving people that I'm working with towards a managed service model, we generally advise them to build basically a sales funnel and just keep running down the list, you know, over and over. And, you know, you'll end up with kind of that 20 to 30% that just won't budge and they don't see the value in it. And that's okay. You can choose to keep them around and have kind of a split between the managed service model and the T&M model, as long as those T&Ms are not disruptive to the rest of the organization. That's the biggest piece. So, you know, one of the pieces we want to talk about was some of the metrics. And to me, that's one of the biggest ones in measuring the quality of the relationships that you have at a business level with your clients is, what is the gross margin that you're making on a contract by contract basis, right? So it's important to understand if you're making money as a business, that's key. But you also need to understand on a client by client basis, are you making money on that contract? And a lot of people will just get blinded by, you know, the money that comes in the door, and they're married to that revenue, not recognizing that, you know, they're making, you know, 10 or 20% or even the fact that it's below water, yet they still, you know, convince themselves to hold on to that contract because it's money in hand, when it's really not as valuable as that money may seem because of the work and the effort and the heartache that goes into it, either from an account management perspective or from a service perspective.
Yeah, that's a really interesting topic. I'd love to focus on metrics. You know, you hit the nail on the head there. Specifically, how to go from a sort of, I don't know, a bit of a sloppy, make it work kind of, you know, method of operating to something a little bit more buttoned up and measurable. You know, for example, like we've been talking here among my team about how there are certain clients that we talk about all the time. There are certain clients that we're we seem to always be tossing around, you know, some new, you know, problem that they're having or sort of like interaction that needs to be assessed or adjusted or something like that. And just generally clients that take more of our time and don't just vaguely don't seem to be providing us enough revenue to sort of make up for it. And again, it's just a vague kind of sense because we don't measure really like the amount of time we're spending talking about each client or, you know, reviewing just work that was done recently. So we're all on the same page or doing sort of a post-mortem on something that went wrong or whatever the case may be. We're not tracking a lot of that time. Also, I don't have a good sense in my sort of bookkeeping system how to run reports to sort of determine, you know, like just overall, like whether a client is profitable in that sense. I mean, I can run a report and say how many hours we've billed them for, but I mean, can you just give me a sense of how to take a business that's we've just sort of grown organically and figured it out as we've went along and make it a little bit more measurable?
Yeah, definitely. So there's a few kind of key topics or KPIs that I like to focus on. And, you know, to start, there's a presentation that I did recently on this that kind of highlights a lot of the metrics that I feel are valuable. And I start out the conversation with a quote from Peter Drucker, who is, you know, he's an old author on management system, and he wrote a book called The Effective Executive. And one of my favorite quotes from Drucker is he says, "What gets measured gets managed." And that's why, to me, metrics, dashboards, and, you know, the sort of the insights that metrics can give you are so valuable. And these are areas that business owners really need to focus on is what are the numbers, what do I expect, and then manage based on exception. So when those metrics are not what you want them to be or what everyone has agreed that they should be, it's not that it gives you the answers to the problems, but it gives you the right questions and where to go looking for, you know, to ask a lot of questions and understand what might be wrong. So the five that I typically like to focus on are tickets per seat, the SLA achievement, utilization, percentage of non-recurrent revenue, and then the EBITDA performance of the company. So the one that you mentioned is kind of ties around the gross margin performance of a contract or a partner, and that's tickets per seat is a great one for that. So industry average would be about one ticket per supported endpoint or user per month. Is generally what you should see. And what you'll notice is some of those organizations that feel really noisy are often up to, you know, 3, 4, or even 5 tickets per seat per month. And what that tells you is that they better be paying the appropriate amount for that, or there's probably projects available to bring down the noise in those environments. So it's really critical to kind of understand what's the level of demand from those individual organizations, and then ask, you know, yourself and your staff, you know, why is the noise level so high? Is this a training issue? Just, you know, Sally keeps calling in with the same problem and asking it over and over again. She doesn't seem to learn. Or, you know, does stuff fall over continuously and we're supporting it and it needs to be replaced with something more stable that we won't have to support? So it gives you that insight of where to go hunting to solve these problems. And in a lot of cases, they require the buy-in and the investment from the partner organization, but not necessarily. It can be stuff you clean up internally, or maybe you have bad data, right? But that's a great one, is tickets per seat.
Yeah, I feel like I have to make a few phone calls. Can you guys hold on a minute? three tickets per seat per month that would be high. Interesting. So one per user per month. Yeah, that I guess that kind of makes sense. I mean, the thing too is like I'm just in the transition point of even putting everything through our help desk, you know, ticketing system. We're still just doing it the old-fashioned way. We get a lot of requests through email that we just address to just knock them down and get them done. And really, we need to be more diligent with, you know, basically forwarding each of those requests into our ticketing system to even begin to track this stuff.
And getting the clients to do it on their own too.
Even better, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think it's interesting to think about that as tickets per seat and per month. I'd even start to look at my metrics, because we use Zendesk, so I do have a better picture and accurate understanding rather than the email or phone calls and things like that. So that's an interesting point, Todd, that you bring up there. So you're just out of curiosity, I mean, your business in terms of what you do, you said you used to do IT consulting, but so are you more management consulting now more than ever? Or do you still do both?
No, I don't tend to get dirty unless I just kind of feel like it. Every once in a while, I still have a nerdy weekend where, I'll start getting dirty on something and building something out. So I still have my technical roots, but, more and more the last, 10 or 12 years of my life have been spent around operations of the business. But, I'll kind of give you the quick encapsulated history. I had a consulting company before I graduated high school, kind of by accident. In a lot of ways, most people are familiar with the story that I was the neighborhood nerd that fixed other people's computers. And eventually, those users had businesses and they said, well, why don't you come over and help me here? And then they'd refer me to their friends. And lo and behold, I was wearing a tie to school and supporting the server infrastructure there. And then after school, going supporting clients in their real estate businesses or whatever that was. And then, fast forward through the course of my professional career, I was one of those techs that said, not going to do management. It's not interesting to me. It just feels like political and dirty somehow. And then as I got a team and sort of understood leadership, I really got a taste for it and really enjoyed it. And then started to, spend more time in the management field and then moving to operations. And I've run multi-million dollar business units for, some of the largest IT companies in Canada. So it's been rewarding, but I've still have that technical base, which I think is important for credibility in an IT organization. But the focus of my business is primarily around the operation of the business. Some of that still can field technical. So, what's the ERP that they're using? What's the backup system? The VCIO function, the virtual CIO function is a big space for a lot of MSPs now. So that can be critical that you have a technical background to be able to make high level, strategic decisions and recommendations for organizations. So technical base, but primarily in the management consulting.
And are you consulting IT-based organizations or just any organization that has an IT infrastructure that needs support on that end?
Largely, my client base is IT organizations. That's generally because it's what I target from a client base. It's where my expertise is, and I have a lot of passion around the evolution, as it were, for that space. But I do have some clients that are not IT-based, and the management framework that I educate people on is applicable in any organization. So I've dealt with, some logistics companies, a couple of nonprofits as clients, that type of thing. So it translates to any style of business, but I generally try to focus on IT organizations just because I feel that there's a need for it. I've been to a few IT conferences. I haven't been to ACES. I plan to check that out in the future. But one thing that always shocked me was, in general, it felt like a lot of the organizations were kind of what you would expect. There's an IT operator that, started growing, roped in his wife as the accountant and, ended up with five staff. And before he realizes it, he's no longer the IT guy. He's running a business and he's suddenly become an entrepreneur without really planning it. And, they quickly get overwhelmed with, how do I manage staff? How do I manage, the client relationships and all of these aspects that they didn't really bank on when they started the business? They just wanted to be, a great service technician that built cool stuff for great partners. And then all of a sudden that stuff starts to disappear in the rear view as they have to focus more on building and maintaining their business, which revolves around different aspects of what they've spent their life on.
Sound familiar, Joe?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Roping in the wife, that was definitely a page out of my playbook.
It's incredibly common. Yeah, it's interesting.
It makes sense in a lot of ways. We did a whole show on it, actually. But yeah, I mean, it makes sense in many ways. And in other ways, it's, it's quite challenging. But I mean, just the overall, just the concept, it certainly speaks to me of, just kind of finding something that I enjoyed doing that, I had a talent for. And lo and behold, people were willing to pay for, it's as simple as that. And then fast forward and now there's so many more aspects to it. I mean, I remember when I got started in this business, I thought, the great thing about it is the overhead. It's such low overhead. I just need a computer, which I already have, it's like now, I mean, the overhead, I can't even begin to describe it, not only in the cost of, the infrastructure here, but just the sort of management overhead of just the whole operation gets to be just a lot more than I bargained for. So that's definitely a common thing that I think a lot of listeners will relate to. What are some things, are there some real strategic things that, you know, some, I don't know, pro tips you can kind of, you know, give our listeners and me among them to, you know, make a real difference in our day-to-day just success of our operation and efficiency?
Yeah, I would say two things that really stand out to me as pretty critical. Well, I guess three, because we've already covered one, is metrics. And the reason for that is you need some type of 10,000 foot view of the organization without having to spend a lot of time asking people questions to discern whether or not you're comfortable with what's going on. Because especially when you're still in that stage of business where you're wearing multiple hats, you need to be able to just kind of glance at something. And, you know, I'm huge on dashboards, right? The organizations that I've worked in and the clients that I advise always end up with dashboards hanging on just about every wall, wherever we can cram them in, because, you know, you can glance up at them and in 5 seconds you determine whether or not you're comfortable with what you see. And if not, then you know exactly who to go ask about what. Right. So huge on dashboards and metrics.
Can you tell our listeners and myself, can you tell us what a dashboard is?
Sure. Sorry. Yeah. So you want to set particular metrics like the ones that we talked about. So, you know, SLA achievement, tech utilization, gross margin performance, you know, ticket volume, kill rate, which is, you know, number of tickets open today versus number of closed, those types of metrics. And it depends on the division that you're looking at. So whether or not it's the service desk, the projects team, or the sales team, all of them have different metrics, but the metrics go up on the dashboard and it kind of pulls from whatever tools you're utilizing to give you real-time snapshots of the numbers. So, you know, those numbers are what you want to be able to quickly view and make sure that, you know, everything's green or within sort of the acceptable parameters. So, you know, for example, hours to resolution on tickets, you know, we want that to be 8 hours. You know, all tickets should be generally closed within 8 hours of SLA time. And you glance up and you see that that's 12. You're like, okay, maybe it's just a bad day. Later on the day, you look up and it's 20. And you can kind of assume, hang on, like stop the record. Let's go see what's going on, because it looks like something's blowing up and maybe I need to be involved. So dashboards are key for that, just being able to get that snapshot view of what's going on.
Wow. Yeah.
Thank you.
Status board comes to mind, right, Jerry? Panic status board.
Yep.
Yeah.
We've
a very primitive sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've talked a little bit about it. And of course, we talked about my, you know, big screen in the office, which everyone's so impressed with and which I really enjoy looking at. But really, it's very limited information. I would love to feed some more, you know, hard data to it. But one thing that it does support out of the box is the number of emails in your inbox. And I've never publish that number because it would be kind of, you know, a little too revealing into the chaos behind the scenes. But I think, you know, there's some things you can just really be held accountable to. If you post those things on a big board, maybe it doesn't have to be customer facing, but, you know, it could be on my wall inside my office. And I think tickets are a good one that I'm pretty sure there's a Zendesk module of some sort. I mean, so a lot of this stuff could be, you know, speaking of a weekend project to kind of get your hands dirty with something, setting up a panic status board on an iPad and plug it into a big screen is a really fun project. And, you know, if you've got the tools set up already, there's some pretty interesting ways to kind of feed them into that system. So that's kind of exciting idea for me.
Yeah, I'm a total dashboard nerd. It's always exciting for me when clients really get it, and I meet with them on Monday and they're like, okay, so I built up four dashboards on the weekend. It was awesome. I think I got some really good insights. Right, it gets crazy deep. It's a lot of fun.
So is there like software you're using to kind of develop those, or is it a, you know, analog kind of system, or what's the how do you create those?
So it depends on the complexity of the organization and what you're using. I just did a quick search. The one that I particularly like is called BrightGauge. And it actually does connect with Zendesk. It'll depend on sort of the level of detail of what the API serves up. And then there's a couple of other that are out there, like Gecko Board, which if you got some coding background can be a little more useful. In general, anything that has a SQL database that you can tap into and run custom queries, you should be able to get some relevant information out of either BrightGauge or Gecko. And there's another one called ConnectSmart. A lot of the organizations that I deal with are less in the Apple space, more around, you know, they use stuff like ConnectWise and Autotask and those types of PSA tools. But the BrightGauge in particular is fantastic because it doesn't feel like it's built by engineers. It's actually very usable, but it's fairly extensible as well. And it does connect with Zendesk, so that would be a good one to check out. So another one that is really helpful is from the Rockefeller Habits, which is the Daily Stand-Up. or the Daily Huddle. And this is literally a standing meeting that is no longer than 10 to 15 minutes where you just circle around. Everyone talks about, you know, what you're focusing on, what you achieved yesterday, any roadblocks or people that you need to connect with to get your work done. And this is kind of short circuits the conversations and the waiting game. What I find this is really helpful for is, you know, Jim is waiting for Bob to get him a quote that he needs to get out to a client. And he hasn't seen that for a couple of days. And in his head, he's assuming that Bob's just busy and hasn't got to it. But if he gets that opportunity to say, you say, you know, is any roadblocks we need to clear? Anyone waiting on anything? Can say, hey, Bob, waiting on that quote. And Bob says, that's right. Yeah, I can get that to you within the hour. It's on my desk. I just haven't sent it. Right. So that can be really effective in kind of clarifying that communication without taking a ton of time out of everyone's day. And the reason that it's standing is so that no one gets comfortable and just sits around, kind of, you know, cooler talk starts and, you know, you're 45 minutes into it and no one's really got anything accomplished. So that can be a big one. And then the other thing that I'm really big on is one-on-ones. So this, in general, you know, teams should be no bigger than probably 8 to 10 people. And what that facilitates is you get a 30-minute meeting with each direct report every week. And this is critical because it helps to build a relationship with your staff and allows sort of more depth of conversation around projects, performance, and issues. So that can be a really, really big one. It requires some time to invest. So you really have to kind of bank that it's going to work for you. There's other recommendations I can make if people are really fundamental that's not going to work for them. There's some shortcuts or some tools, but my first stop is always spending the time for that 30-minute one-on-one with your staff. It pays massive dividends in relationship and performance building for the growth of your team.
So that actually brings me to a question I have about the types or size of companies that you manage. First of all, I want to say that Daily Huddle sounds actually pretty interesting, only because, you know, we have a meeting once a week every Monday. We get together early and make sure we hit all of our Zendesk tickets and discuss calendars and everything, and it's great. But it takes quite a while and it's extensive, and you feel kind of overwhelmed at the end of the meeting because you realize just how much you have to do that week. But the little quick 10-minute blips throughout the week could be a big benefit to just making sure you hit all the little points and don't get too stressed out when you save everything for a weekly meeting. So anyway, I thought that was kind of neat. But the other piece of it that I was thinking of was in terms of the size of the organizations that you support, you know, meeting with your staff and things like that. I'm a pretty small organization. I think Joe's the largest out of us three. Well, in Connecticut, I'm small. But what type of size company do you typically support?
Organizations that I work with tend to be kind of 10 plus people, but you know, the fundamentals are still there. If you're in a high growth organization, or you know, you want to set the systems in place that will facilitate your growth when you're bigger, you want to build that into the company's DNA. So from that aspect, I don't think it necessarily differs. And in some respect, it might actually make more sense when you're smaller, right? Because if you don't have a team of 20, you know, you're not worried about, you know, the middle manager and how that manager is attending to the rest of your team. If you're small enough that all of the direct reports are yours and it's kind of just four or five people, perfect. Then, you know, you can build a tight squad, build really deep relationships with those guys. And if and when you grow, then, you know, that's built into the culture and it's expected. So, but in general, the organizations that I work with tend to be, you know, 10 to 50 people.
Joe will be there soon.
Yeah, maybe. We'll see if I make it that far. I mean, it's funny the timing here, because we've just recently implemented this very idea of this quick, like, daily sort of check-in, we've been calling it. One thing that I've found difficult is just that the schedule on a daily basis changes so much, and we try to stick to, you know, scheduling things during sane business hours. And then inevitably what happens is it's like, all right, I really need to do this, but I'm booked all day. So I'll do this tonight, you know, and it's like, okay, I've got something on my calendar at 8 o'clock now, you know, or okay, I better do this first thing tomorrow. And then it goes on the calendar at, you know, 8 o'clock or something in the morning. And then it eats into it eats into our, you know, what should be our sort of personal time, but also it eats into any kind of plan to meet regularly, even remotely, let alone in person. I do think there's a lot of value to meeting in person. Like you said, Todd, there's just sort of like a higher bandwidth to it. And you can just sort of all chat about what the status is. And so everybody gets to be on the same page much more easily. You know, even better than what's the best alternative, Slack or something like that. I mean, I've just never made a digital tool work where, you know, a standing meeting can really work very well. But it's hard enough to schedule our team meeting and stick to it, you know, to block off that time at 9 o'clock every Monday morning and just stick to it, because inevitably calls come in and we're trying to sort of juggle the new requests with the existing ones we're discussing, or we've got to return a server first thing Monday morning and get it up and running, and that eats into the team meeting. So I don't know, there's practical considerations here, but if you can make it work, it is really valuable to have not only the weekly all hands, you know, full sort of meeting, but also these very regular, you know, daily if possible, 10-minute check-in meetings, which I have to credit my office manager, Judy, with implementing just this past week. So the timing is kind of uncanny, but I can speak to the value of those for sure.
Yeah, and if you have the metrics to back them up, that can be kind of a really powerful combination that really helps facilitate, you know, the exceptions. You don't want to get caught in the stories and the blah, blah, blah about, you know, why something is. It doesn't really matter, right? You know, one of my fundamental principles is management is about affecting the future. The past is kind of irrelevant other than a learning lesson. So, you know, you always want to be focused on, you know, what does this mean? Therefore, what's the next step? What are we doing about, you know, what we observe? And you're right, you know, especially with teams that require remote support, or especially if you're spread across, you know, multiple cities, if you're growing, that type of stuff, you know, there's nothing wrong with a phone call to do those check-ins. And, you know, the standing meetings that I did, you know, you'd grab a bunch of people and stand them in the same room, but then you'd connect on, you know, a Skype call or Slack audio or a dial-in bridge, and everyone just dials in from where they're at. And just as long as you acknowledge them on the phone and cycle through them in that stand-up, it's not an issue. Again, it's pretty tough to argue that people can't make 10 minutes in their day to do something that is important, right? And that's not to say that, you know, everything goes out the window instead. If there's emergency issues to deal with, then yeah, that has to be addressed. And, you know, if you miss a stand-up, no big deal. But, you know, if you miss a stand-up every day of the week, then maybe that's a problem, right? So it's finding that delicate balance. As long as you have the majority of the team there to connect, then it still makes sense.
Yeah, the focus is key. I guess you're saying, you know, don't go into the, you know, psychological constitution of any particular client for 45 minutes to an hour in analyzing that postmortem aspect of the technical situation, you know, like we may do sometimes. You know, we find ourselves just going deep into the psychology of a situation sometimes, you know, why it went a certain way, or, you know, how we could have done better, or why a client is frustrating to work with, or any number of things. We get derailed in sometimes venting about that stuff, but focus is key. Just stay, like you said, focusing on, how did you put it, sort of affecting the future, you know, looking into outcomes and how we want to do things better in the future, and not getting bogged down into, you know, I don't know, just like how a situation, why it went a certain way, or, you know, why you're not getting along with a certain client or whatever.
Yeah, and those things can either come up in the one-on-one to be addressed, or you schedule a separate meeting for it, right? So when you're doing any type of meeting, you want to stick to the agenda, even if it's a stand-up, and, you know, you just say, you can be polite about it. Say, look, you know, I hear what you're saying. I think we need to move on. If you need, we can schedule a follow-up to review this if it's important. But, you know, we need to get to, you know, Jim here, who's and be respectful of everyone's time. So it doesn't necessarily have to be the, hey, shut up, let's move on, right? You can be respectful about it. But yeah, you definitely want to use a parking lot it's a term for, you know, those things that are not necessarily relevant to the meeting, but probably have some importance. And, you know, we can schedule a meeting with just the two of us to follow up. And that's another thing with group meetings. You know, like I saw this expression, you need management approval for a $500 expense, but you can invite five people to a 2-hour meeting and no one notices.
Right.
And there's sort of that relevance around the cost of time, and people hate being stuck in meetings that aren't relevant to them. So if there's a follow-up and some dialogue that needs to happen, maybe it's only two people instead of five people that need to be involved in that discussion. Free everyone up to go about their day. And, you know, if that person wants to stick around right now and talk about it, or we schedule something for tomorrow, then that's a little more efficient, right?
I might need more like a parking garage patch for some of the issues we've belabored over the years. By the way, it's a lot of times it's me. You know, it's not my staff necessarily that I need to keep on target. I'm just as guilty as anybody. But in any case, it is the agenda. You know, the idea of having an agenda, I found that was very beneficial. You know, early on we would wing it, and up until even recently, we've oftentimes winged it in these meetings where we have a team meeting. We know we need to discuss, you know, the prior week and the week ahead and stuff like that, and whatever everybody else brings to the table. But we would just sort of review the calendar live, you know, review what's on our, you know, what projects we're working on live. But we found it's obviously way more efficient if we all just spend a little bit of time ahead of time building a list of things that we need to focus on, or just noting on the calendar, noting the appointments that we need to, you know, specifically review, as opposed to just sort of like, you know, looking at the calendar and going through it one by one during the meeting. Having that agenda prepared ahead of time is just obviously way more efficient. And then you can focus the meeting around that.
Yeah, definitely. You can have working meetings, but working meetings are different from meetings, right? And that needs to be an important distinction. I agree. It's really tough to stick with the regularity of maintaining an agenda beforehand. I think where a lot of this helps is if, you know, you kind of pair up with people. So if you have someone that is kind of your right-hand man in the organization, or you have an office admin staff person that can help you out with this and kind of keep control of the logistics around those meetings, that can be helpful, because it's difficult to run a meeting as well as kind of keep the meeting logistics on course and facilitate that meeting. So that facilitation and logistics can be delegated out to someone else. That can help improve the efficiency for everybody as a result. Because as you said, you know, it could be the person leading the meeting that keeps dragging it out and wanting to talk about something. Someone else needs to have been given kind of the approval and the authority to say, all right, you know, Joe, slow down. Okay, we need to put this in the parking lot and address it later, right?
Parking garage.
A lot of staff will be very cautious to cut off their boss in the middle of a meeting, right?
True. Yeah, no, I've definitely addressed that point as well. Like, you know, you feel free to jump in and keep us on track. I'm curious, Sam, how your team meetings, you know, go. How do you, you know, how do you sort of hold those? How do they work? How long do they last?
You want my inner secrets,
Joe? I do.
Well, yeah. So we generally try and meet before the 9 o'clock workday starts. So sometimes 8 or 8:30 to get a jump on that, because on a Monday morning, you know, calls can start to come in right away. So it's something you don't want to get too distracted by. But we'll just sit down. We'll go through a roundtable of calendar. Then we'll go through the Zendesk tickets and what's out there, what's been open the longest, and try and address why something hasn't been tackled. And, you know, go through also people that don't use the system that we have in place and send an email to one person. And now we have to address it by putting it in Zendesk. But then also trying to spend some time developing new projects. I think that's the big piece that I used to overlook a ton. Was I was just always working, you know, doing my break fix, that I never had time to develop projects and meet with a client and say, you need to change email hosting plans, or you need to do this. So we try and dedicate a good amount of time for that, because that's where the new revenue comes in. You know, you can make only so much doing break fix for so long.
Yeah, that hits on another metric that I like, which is NRR, which is non-recurrent revenue. And that should be at least 25% of your overall revenue for the organization. Because what that indicates is both that you're looking for those opportunities to create project revenue, and it also, it's interesting stuff for the team to work on. Like that stuff's just a little more cool than the day-to-day support. But also it indicates the partnership and their level of willingness to invest in the future and invest in keeping their infrastructure current. And, you know, it should, you know, reduce your overall support load so that the contracts are more profitable because you're not doing reactive support. So it definitely has a benefit. And if you're feeling overwhelmed with this stuff, this is a prime opportunity for delegation and the development of your staff. And if you can effectively get people involved in kind of taking this stuff on, even if you only have like one or two other people, you know, look to who you feel is your right-hand man or woman and be able to delegate that stuff off and help them develop it for you. And that, you know, takes the burden off of you as sort of the sole operator that's responsible for the 8 or 10 different executive responsibilities, even in a small business. And the other benefit is that they'll love and appreciate that. People love to grow and they want to have those challenges. And if you can kind of put them in a safe space to work on something with you to develop that project funnel, that'll be a huge benefit for you, both in kind of their development, but as well as, you know, their loyalty and their vision of investment in the organization for you.
You know, it's funny that you bring that up in just terms of helping them grow, because I used to have this concern that I'd put too much on my employee to say, well, do this or try this and work on this, when I knew his comfort zone, what he was good at. And I think that's an important piece to bring out in people, and just try and get them out of that comfort zone and learn something new and grow themselves as an individual in the organization. They can feel like they're doing more and contributing more. If you're just kind of handing them like an IT task and say, go fix this computer, they don't really have a lot of responsibility besides the direction you just put them in. So I like that thought process that you have. I do have to remember all these acronyms that you're throwing out here, but NRR, right? Non-recurring revenue. But just putting some responsibility on them to develop this task is what you're saying, right? So give them this task to try and develop what we're working on, reactive versus what we can grow the business with.
Yeah, and certainly if you're clear with them up front that, you know, to some degree, it's okay to fail, right? That you know, I'm going to give you a safe space to do this. You know, I'm not going to give you, you know, a $100,000 budget for the next 6 months to kind of do this. But, you know, here's a framework of a project that I think would be good. You know, spend some time reviewing these 3 or 4 clients and come back to me with some recommendations on what we should be offering to those clients. And then, you know, if they're mature enough, then maybe have them lead the sale or the pitch with, teamed up with you. And it really helps to develop the kind of the relationship and that camaraderie, right? They see you as giving them responsibility, but still supporting them. And if they do something wrong, it's not, you know, hey, you screwed this up. It's, oh, okay, well, what will we do next time? All right, no big deal. You know, we've learned from this and you know, how can we adapt? So that's one of the really critical components, is that people have to feel safe in failing. And that's a growth moment, not something that they're going to be punished for, right? So the clear expectation on that, and as long as those parameters are safe for the business, that you're not going to have someone go out and buy a bunch of product and cost you a ton of money, then that can be a great growth point for the relationship and for the staff.
So, Todd, do you find that sort of growth potential is incentive enough, or, you know, is it sometimes in our interest to incentivize our staff financially in some way with some kind of a, you know, commission or like a, you know, performance based reward of some sort?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't have the quote exactly handy right now. I can throw this to you guys later, but there's a great quote from a book that I still have that I read a long, long time ago, and it's called Leading Geeks. And it talks about the perceived value of money. And for me, if anyone asks for a raise, it's usually indicative as a relationship to value, right? So as long as people have enough money that, you know, they're comfortable and their lifestyle is met, I find in general geeks tend to not be coin operated, is a term I use. You know, you see those sales guys where, you know, you just keep feeding coins into them and they'll do exactly what you want. They'll sell anything. And people that end up in the IT industry, I don't feel really trend towards that. And a lot of people are kind of at a loss of how to motivate their staff, and they look at commission structures and try and incentivize them with money, and they're kind of mystified by why these guys don't sort of grab at the cash on the table. And it's because, you know, money is not necessarily the objective. Money is simply a representation of the value that is placed on them. So that can be kind of an interesting shift. And that's why I suggest, you know, giving them responsibility and a relationship that they can feel valued in, that can often be way more powerful. You don't have to give people, you know, gigantic raises to make sure that they stick around, just as long as they feel that they're a valuable member of the team and that they can feel, you know, some level of accomplishment on what they're working on. And a lot of it honestly has to do with feeling a closeness and a kinship with their boss and the people that they're working with. That can be a way higher value than the money. You know, that said, there's still, you need to pay, you know, market rate. And, you know, if someone's doing excellent and you want to keep them around, you should consider, you know, do I need to give this person a raise in order to fend off the wolves that may potentially try and poach them? That's still a consideration, but never assume that money is the key piece that will incentivize people or keep them around. One of the systems that I use is called DISC, D-I-S-C, and it's a behavioral model that. When I start working with teams, I get everyone to do a DISC assessment. And one of the components is it's all kind of ideas around their behavioral style. You know, what motivates them is a big factor in indication, their communication style, you know, what they're looking for, and, you know, how to generally engage them and motivate them, but also how they're going to work with the team. So those pieces can be really insightful in how you're actually managing your staff if you better understand what motivates them.
Yeah, like you said, some people may be motivated by the personal relationship, whether it's with, you know, with us as business owners or just the rest of the staff, or the relationship with, you know, the clients they get to work with. You know, certain clients they may be more interested in working with, and they may therefore be motivated to, you know, design projects for those clients. Some people may be motivated, on the other hand, by working with cool technology, like just wanting to play with the latest toys. And so they, you know, write up a project proposal based on that. I guess that comes from just getting to know your staff better and building that rapport through those, you know, regular meetings and things like that.
Yeah, definitely.
So, Jerry, how do your team meetings look on a weekly basis?
I'm the silent partner in this whole conversation. Well, being an army of one, it's very difficult to stay on track with a lot of
measurements and operational.
Yeah,
it's
difficult to take the 10,000-foot view when you're hitting the ground running every single day and just trying to put bread on the table. So, you know, all really valuable advice. One of the valuable things that I got of what Todd just mentioned was some of the key things that keep people interested in their companies and keep them involved. And I believe when we had Jonathan Spiva on from 74-Bit, that was a conversation and a question that we actually put to him. Well, he has very, very talented people working for them. And we asked him, well, how does he keep his people? And he gives them a very, very long leash, meaning that he lets them be very, very autonomous in how they operate, what technologies they decide to use, and how they work with the clients. And I think that's really, really valuable, that your company employees are not always looking for the bottom line. They're looking to feel valued and to feel like they're contributing to the organization and their talents and their techniques are being put to good use.
Yeah, it's a really good point, because, I mean, that level of sort of freedom is one of the main reasons I sort of got into this line of work, you know, and certainly one of the main reasons I enjoy working for myself, as it were, because, you know, you can sort of make all those decisions. And a lot of times we're going to be hiring people that have similar motivations to us, like that got into consulting, working directly with people, you know, and employing these technology solutions. And they may be really good at their job, and they may have the opportunity to just keep doing it for themselves. And like, what would motivate them to stick around and remain a member of the team? And, you know, I think that for many people, you may be absolutely right, Jerry, that they would want to have that level of freedom and autonomy to, you know, to just almost be running their own little, you know, mini consulting practice within the broader organization in some sense.
That's right.
Yeah, that's exactly how I used to phrase this to, you know, I used to lead teams of consultants for, you know, a large organization in Canada. And I used to say to them, who here owns their own business? And, you know, one or two people would put their hand up because they got some gig on the side. And I'd say, wrong, you all own your own business. You are your own personal brand, right? And as much as I don't want to dig too deep into, you know, the brand identity piece and that idea, it has some relevance. And I believe that most people, not all, but most, have some type of entrepreneurial thread in them. And the way I like to spin this is, before I was a business owner, I used to describe myself as an intrapreneur, because, you know, I would go into organizations and look for, you know, a business efficiencies. And that was really how I've always been wired. Like, I love efficiency, you know, the lean approach to things and process optimization. I just find that stuff really, really satisfying. I love cleaning up organizations. And that's a large part of why I do this business that I do, is working to help other organizations see, you know, the latent value that they have within their organizations. And that sort of ideology can still be instilled in your staff. And, you know, you can motivate them with, view this as your own business. And, you know, if I give you that slack and you're, you know, doing your own thing, and that provides sort of its own inherent value and self-worth. There's a great book that talks a lot about this from a guy named Jack Stack, and it's called The Great Game of Business. And it talks about open book management. And this can be a little scary for small business operators, but it talks about really kind of having true transparency on the operation of the business. You know, how much money are we making? You know, where are we spending money? And he gets into these these really bizarre stories, and a lot of it deals with enterprise organizations like, you know, GM and stuff like that. But, you know, he talked to people really on the ground, and they end up saving, you know, $10,000 a year in toilet paper, and how this the toilet paper gets utilized, right? And if you kind of motivate people to look for these opportunities and really take the opportunity to jump on some of these things, it's amazing how far they'll run with it. Just, you know, the cautionary is that not everyone's wired that way. A lot of people just kind of want to show up and do their thing, and they're, as long as they're incredibly productive, then great. You don't want to force everyone to kind of be their own business operator, but as much as you can make them feel that they have an invested interest and they have some visibility and some effect on the overall business, that can be a huge performance motivator as well.
Yeah, there are days where you know, I just wish somebody would tell me what to do and where to go, and you know, it just tell me what to do. I just want to punch in and punch out. But for the most part, I think that one of the, you know, complaints I've heard the most frequently from anybody in any field is a frustration with not having that autonomy, not their boss or their management structure not listening to that feedback about how things could be improved and how the company could, you know, operate more efficiently or you know, like you said, save money in certain areas and things like that. And so I think that really strikes a chord. I mean, people are frustrated with not being heard or not, you know, not having an effect on, you know, what they do every day, like not being, having any level of control over that. And that's, it's really not very nice to put someone in a position where it's like a top-down approach where they just have no, you know, no ability to affect their day-to-day experience whatsoever. I mean, that's just a really crazy thing to do to somebody. But the toilet paper example reminded me of an episode of The Office where Dwight goes down to one ply toilet paper, I think, because he buys the building or something, and then he tried anyway. What came to mind there?
Yeah, the point that you made, it's nothing drives me more crazy. I guess there's probably a few things. Something that drives me particularly crazy is when people get it in their head that they want to do a staff survey, and then they do nothing with the results. It's really frustrating for the staff that, you know, okay, I'm going to do this an anonymous survey and I'm going to give you some actual feedback, and then they never hear anything about it. It can be really demotivating that, you know, they'll never give you any type of feedback going forward because you've squandered the times that they've tried to give you some feedback before that. And this is one of the ways that I used to leverage this idea to really win the trust of my staff. It's funny, I'm writing a blog post about this right now, that I always look for those quick wins. Whenever I took over a new team that I was managing, I kind of talked to everyone and asked them, you know, what do you need? What have you been asking for? And just sort of try to tweeze out those things that have, you know, everyone's been talking about and they've been asking for, but it just seems that it's fallen on deaf ears. And take one or two of those and champion them for either an individual or a team. And once they see that you kind of picked that thing up off the ground and ran with it, it really garners a ton of trust. That people will be like, oh, okay, you know, this guy's for real. He has an interest in what we need, and he's willing to kind of step up to the plate and do these things. That can really be helpful. So if you're going to get staff feedback, make sure you're doing something with it. Not necessarily with every little piece that floats up to you, but you at least have to acknowledge it and explain why you're not going to do something, or, you know, give them the perspective that they're unaware of why you can't do something with it. But that staff feedback is incredibly valuable. But if you do nothing with it, you won't get a lot of it.
That's a really good point. Wow. Hey, quick wins. That reminds me of, I think, something Shelley Watson brought up recently. A term I think her partner Chris came up with. Was it quick kills or something like that?
Yeah, quick kills, yeah. I think it was. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of just like one of those big wins, you know, you can just really quickly like change somebody's, you know, experience, really kind of win somebody over very quickly. And I don't like the idea of kill, you know, a quick kill, because it sounds kind of negative, but a quick win, that has a certain ring to it. I like that.
Like, how come every time I reboot my Mac, all these applications start up at once?
Right. I can fix I can fix that.
There's a quick win right there.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good one. Right. And it's the question, sometimes in those cases, people don't even realize that it's like, it's frustrating to them. Like, and you have to just sort of notice it as it happens. Like, you know, okay, all the windows fly off the screen and you're like, does that happen to you often? Yes, that's so annoying. Why does it? And it's like, well, it's hot corners. I'll just give me 2 seconds. Okay, you're done. You know, fixed, problem solved. And then you just closed a deal. You know, you closed like a $10,000 contract or something. Yeah.
That to me was always one of the most rewarding aspects of the on-the-ground tech work, where you go into an office, you know, to support, you know, a user with an issue. And they're, you know, you see like, oh, they're super frustrated, like, rah, 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 rah. And, you know, you're like, oh, okay, I've seen this. You do a couple of clicks and it's super easy for you. But then, like, they're absolutely ecstatic with the result. And they're like, oh, my God, you're so awesome. This is amazing. Right. You're like a tech god. And, you know, you're like, in your head, you're thinking, oh, that was pretty easy. Like, there's nothing super fancy about what I did. But it's still incredibly rewarding to the ego to have these people just fawning over how smart
totally,
you are.
Right? Totally. Keeps you going. Definitely. I get that with Command Tab sometimes, you know. What did you just do? Yeah. What was that? What was that? You just switched
all
really quickly.
You know, it's
like, command, ready? Command, tab. Whoa, that's amazing. Yeah, that's fun. It is really what keeps us showing up, I think. You know, just those, the ability to, I don't know, maybe it's a vain thing, but it's like the ability to impress people, really the ability to make a change in someone's life, you know, that they're going to feel happy about. On that philosophical note, I think it's probably time to wrap up the show. Todd, it's been great talking to you. I think we could probably go for 2 more hours about these topics. So maybe we'd love to have you back on in the future if you're willing. It's been really great talking to you.
Yeah, this has been fun, you guys. I agree. We could go on for hours, but I think it's getting late on the East Coast, so I'd love to come back another time. We can either go a little deeper on this stuff or shift to some other areas. It'd be awesome.
Definitely.
Todd, on the front side of the show, we mentioned your podcast. How can people find you on the internets?
Twitter, Todd A. Kane, Kane. My website is evolvedmgmt.com, evolvedmanagementmgmt.com. Yeah, those are probably the 2 best spots. The podcast is available in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Otherwise, you can hit up the website and check that out. Also, if you go to the website, there's a hidden URL I can maybe send to you guys and include in the show note if anyone wants to connect with me for a consultation on anything, on some things that they want to help out in their business. I can be made available for a consultation for your listeners.
Yeah, that's a great point. Just a little bit more, if you could speak to that. Just what is your reach? Let's say somebody in Australia, in Brisbane right now, is listening and saying, this is our guy. This is the guy we want. You travel anywhere and you'll...
Yeah, I'll travel anywhere, but also, you know, the work I can generally do remotely. There's definitely some value in being face to face if it makes financial sense for both parties to do that. But mm-hmm. You know, even engaging remotely over Skype and, you know, just providing some guidance and some feedback. Often, what people really need is perspective. And you know, I bring an outside perspective with a ton of history, and I know, you know, what works and what doesn't, and I can kind of short circuit people's frustration with continuing to throw spaghetti at the wall and find nothing sticks. So I can tell you what works and what doesn't and what how to move forward. And a lot of that can be done remotely, just as a, you know, health check and some guidance on the business.
Terrific.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Todd, for joining us. Todd Kane, president of Evolved Management Consulting, and listeners, check him out at evolvedmgmt.com, and look forward to talking again in the future, Todd.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.